Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Constant listeners, and welcome yet again to The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast from the Consequence Podcast Network. My name is Rockin' Randall Colburn, and who is sitting across from me?
This would be Michael Merrill Rothman.
Ah, that works.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
That works, since today we are here to discuss Castle Rock.
Castle Rock.
Season 2. Heavily anticipated. We've discussed it a lot on the podcast. Today we are going to do a breakdown of the first three episodes, and that will be probably the extent of our coverage. We might revisit it later, depending, you know, on how the future episodes shake out and what we think about the season, where it goes. But whereas last year we did sort of episode to episode coverage of the show, this time around, I think this will suffice.
I think so. I mean, look, 2018 was a pretty busy year for Stephen King,
yeah.
But it's not as crazy as it is this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a lot. So, but before
year.
We get into that, let's do a little house cleaning, or not house cleaning.
What housekeeping.
Housekeeping. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. So,
who's
first
a housekeeper in King's Dominion? Carrie's mom. No, she worked at the linens. But I guess
the woman who licks the cum off the stuff in Nightmares and Dreamscapes.
Yeah. Okay. We'll go. I don't know that name, but.
And then also, I guess, like the in the Institute, there's a housekeeper character who's very important.
Oh.
No spoilers, though.
Okay, no spoilers then.
But yeah, so a little housekeeping. First off, if you are following us on our socials, and if you aren't, you should. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Fresh content across all mediums. And but one thing that is universal across all mediums is our 31 Days of Horror. I guess I could call it a challenge if you want to challenge yourself.
It's a challenge.
I don't know if any of you have been watching each movie every night. If you have, thank you.
I don't think we've been watching it.
No,
each movie.
No. I've watched like a handful of horror movies, but not as much as I probably should. I've been watching On Becoming a God in Central Florida.
I've been wanting to watch that show because
it's
I
good.
Love Kirsten Dunst.
I struggled a little bit at first, but man, it's good. It's about a bit of a horror show, as it is about pyramid schemes. A pyramid scheme.
The horrors of America.
Thing. Yeah, seriously. it's timely. It's interesting. I like it a lot. That's my recommendation for Showtime's On
for
Becoming
Showtime.
A God. They are our sponsors for this episode. Just
yeah,
kidding.
Yeah.
No. So, 31 Days of Horror. We've basically on our socials, we've been posting different movies every day that we would recommend you watch, ones that we all like, and we've each been writing little blurbs about what we think makes that movie special. And today, well, what's the day? This is going up tomorrow.
Tomorrow, we've got a good one, a special anthology movie.
Ooh.
So we're talking about an anthology series.
I don't think we need to not say it because it's coming out tomorrow.
Yeah.
The episode is coming out tomorrow, so it'll be today.
It'll
when
be
they
today
listen to
when you're actually listening. Spoiler alert, because you could actually just look at the image that we shared at the beginning of the month. It's Tales from the Hood. And I love Tales from the Hood.
Tales from the Hood is so, so good.
I watched that earlier this month, I believe. Or no, it was actually September. And I remember being like, we got to put this on our list. This is just a great movie.
Is it playing at the Masquer coming up?
Nah.
Is that
I
where
wish.
It's playing? I thought it played on the big screen somewhere recently.
It played, I think it was last year that it played.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Love it.
Spooky movie, great use of violins in the score.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And yeah, so follow along with that. We still got another week of horror movies that we would love to hear from you guys about if you are enjoying them. Also, so coming up, just the next few episodes to give you a sense of what to expect, we are going to switch things up a bit. We usually talk about books before we talk about movies or the adaptations when we are doing a book episode. But we are going to switch it up a little bit this time because it turns out that Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep is getting released a little earlier than initially thought. It's supposed to come out November 8th.
Yeah.
And now it's getting some special Halloween screenings.
I think Warner Brothers was like, well, this is one of the more anticipated horror movies of the year.
Yeah.
It's spooky season. And we're releasing this a week after Halloween.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do some sort of special engagement. And they did.
I think they've got a lot of faith in this project.
I think they do.
Because they bumped up the release date and now they're doing this. And usually you just see them like put, you know, like like pushing things out of the way down the line. So it actually seems like they have a lot of faith in it, and we're excited for it. So we're hoping that it's a positive response that we have, because today's episode will not be horribly positive, but I think we have nuanced thoughts.
We do.
Nuanced thoughts. So this isn't just a hate fest. So cut us some slack, guys. We're here with the critical, the thoughtful commentary. We're not just haters.
We're not the hateful two.
We're not the hateful two. I swear we aren't. We love Stephen King, and you'll hear that in our Wastelands episode, which just dropped. So if you haven't listened to that, go back and listen. That was last week. And we're doing the movie next week because it comes out, so that'll be like our Halloween episode. We'll be talking about Dr. Sleep because we are going to see it in that early screening, and then the following week when the movie goes wide, I guess, I don't know how they're doing the Halloween screenings, we're going to discuss the book. And we are switching up the chronological order. We usually do them chronologically, but we figured we'd try something new. So since the movie's coming out, why not do the book and switch things up a little bit? And I will say it's interesting because I'm seeing, like, you know, latter-day King stuff, sort of the seeds of what I've been seeing in The Dark Half and in The Tommyknockers and even in different Four Past Midnight, not different seasons. I feel like I'm seeing elaborated versions of in Dr. Sleep, especially the talk about sobriety and the struggle with addiction, because that stuff is so prevalent, like where we are right now in King's Canon, because he was getting sober. And then in Dr. Sleep, you see this sort of like living with sobriety.
It's a nice link.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting to see that kind of connection.
It's going
to
be interesting actually talking about his modern works for the first time on this podcast, because we've never really been able to do that other than when we, you know, do these little capsule reviews for, say, like The Outsider or
Institute. 20s
Button Box Institute.
We talked about Institute a few weeks ago. You can go back and check that out
too. Can.
So next week is the movie of Dr. Sleep. The following week, it'll be the book. And we'll keep you posted on what to expect after that.
And we're trying to secure an interview with Mike Flanagan. You talked to him a couple years ago for
he
Gerald's Game.
Great. I love talking to him.
Yeah, and we are most likely going to be talking to the Newton brothers who did the score for Dr. Sleep. Since I know all of you are really excited to talking to composers, hearing from composers on the podcast.
Yeah, but like, I feel like the Shining score is so iconic, it's got to be interesting to hear.
It is very interesting.
How you follow that.
Yeah, so spoiler, I have heard the score.
Yeah.
And let's just say, God, they have not forgotten the face of their father, to borrow from Critic King.
That's
who just recently loved the new Child's Play remake.
He also, actually, you know what? He also loved Dr. Sleep. I mean, of course he loves everything.
He loves everything.
But I'm going to just read his tweet here just to get everyone excited
to
about...
To whet our appetite for our return to the Overlook Hotel. Which is what's going to happen.
Absolutely. So he tweeted out... yesterday, I believe, Dr. Sleep, so that would have been Wednesday. Dr. Sleep, Mike Flanagan is a talented director, but he's also an excellent storyteller. The movie is a good thing. You'll like this if you like The Shining, but you'll also like it if you like Shawshank. It's immersive. I find this like a weirdly loaded tweet, not in a bad way, but there's a lot going on here. Like when he says he's a good director, but he's also a good storyteller, the movie is a good thing. Like, it's just weird.
Yeah, well, the good thing makes me think that there's some sort of damage control being done with the legacy of The Shining. For his sake.
Yeah.
You know, because obviously he doesn't like Kubrick's version.
Yeah.
And this is paying in debt. You know, this is indebted to that movie, as we've seen in the promotional materials. And I mean, you can't listen to even a teaser trailer or a TV trailer without hearing the iconic theme from Wendy Carlos. So I feel like King is finally coming to peace with things, and I think he's probably going to credit Mike Flanagan for that.
Yeah. And I think when he says he's an excellent storyteller, it just strikes me that I feel like maybe Flanagan, and we know he is, he's bridging this gap between the book and the film.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, because when I spoke to him on this podcast, he was very much like, fidelity is everything. Like, you really need to trust the word on the page. So in this case, it sounds like he's trusting it, but I think he also is forced to reckon with the film as well. And I think it's in the bridging of those gaps is what King says when he's talking about him being a good storyteller.
I think he's just going to really match the aesthetics of the original Kubrick film, because based on the score, I mean, there are literal, I mean, I listen to the Shining score all the time. Not the score, but the scrapbook of scores, because it's you know, it's a variety of music that Kubrick, used and elaborated on. And all the touchstones of the original Shining are in this score.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even like the little bells, like the violin that plays, you know, when there are, you know, revelations being made in the original film, and you'll just notice a lot of sound cues in there. So just knowing that it's that embedded, I mean, and this is like a 40 track score. So
yeah.
It is all over this thing. So I just imagine that he really is trying to kind of match the tone and aesthetic of that original film. I mean, he said that there are not going to be any jump scares, which is just an absolute, like, that makes me so
what
hated.
A joy.
Total joy. Because that, I mean, honestly, that was my least favorite part about It Chapter 2 or Pet Sematary or any of the recent ones that we've had.
I'm just like, unless, I don't know, unless it's a jump scare factory and that's all it really is trying to be, because I will say, like, Annabelle Comes Home is not like a good movie, but when you just look at it as sort of this like endlessly like recycling Jack in the Box, it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I still don't love it, but at the same time, like, I appreciate that it's not really trying to be anything more.
Yeah.
And whereas movies that are really trying to scare you on multiple levels, I just think that jump scares cheapen that often.
I agree.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. That's just, I mean, maybe one or two here and there, but, and also I think jump scares really need, if you're going to do one, it needs to be, like, it needs to be really well calibrated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't the best jump scare people say is like Exorcist 3, you know?
Yeah. And because it's so, I mean, they really earn it.
Yeah.
You know, they build up that tension. They build up that tension to the point where you are just, you're hoping for it.
Right.
And then when it actually does happen, you're so fucking taken off guard that it really doesn't, you know, hits
you. Like, you got to earn these, you know? And that's what,
I mean, it's, even Kubrick did jump scares. I mean, looking back at Shining, I mean, when Jack comes around the corner, that's a jump scare.
Right.
You know?
But,
I mean,
they're well-placed, they're rare, and they're set up exceedingly well. And that's, I think, what is needed. And so, I guess, when I think of, you know, you look at so much studio horror and the jump scare just exists. That's why the noises get louder.
Yeah.
Like, that's why the stings get louder and shriekier, because they know the jump scare wouldn't work without it.
I think a lot of it's emblematic of just how we are as a culture these days, where, you know, and I know I'm not going to sound like, you know, old man that yells at a cloud.
No, we're very old man yells at cloud today, attitude-wise.
We definitely are. but I do think a lot of it just happens to be, like, the same thing with, like, where punk rock eventually goes on a long enough timeline. It's just like, all right, let's just go crank it out louder. Let's just turn out the distortion.
Yep.
And let's just hit the same chords harder.
Yep.
And in horror, when you do that, it just, it becomes intoxicating, and it's not fun anymore. It
not
just
in a
becomes
good
berating.
Way. Like, intoxicating can be good.
It can be good,
but not in that sense.
Yeah. Like, it becomes like poisoned.
Yeah.
And when that happens in horror, it becomes exhausting. I mean, like, I think of like The Curse of La Llorona, which came out earlier this year. And I literally needed like Advil after that movie.
Yeah.
And I think you said the same thing
that
for
was
like,
me
Lights,
with Lights Out.
Yeah.
I hated Lights Out. And because that to me was just, I felt like I literally had a headache coming out of that movie, because it was like, stop screaming in my ear is
enough.
Like what that movie is.
It's
and that's not enough. What horror is to me.
Well, hey, here's one thing that doesn't have a jump scare. Or maybe not. It has a few, but not too many.
Castle Rock
season 2.
Nice segue there. Okay.
Trying to keep it going.
We're searchers, you and me. But you deserve a chance to make a place in the world. See, I'm a searcher who just wants to settle. Wants it bad. Just can't seem to find that place that'll live up to you, my perfection.
You want to tell me what you're doing in this place?
Well, that's a fine thing to say to a customer.
Customer who has brought the host of problems to my town, which already has enough problems.
You don't know a cock-a-doody thing about us. This town is not a good place.
We're running from something, aren't we?
I will always do anything to keep you safe.
So, yeah, let's talk about Castle Rock. We're not going to do any sections with this. I think we're just going to kind of have a free-flowing conversation. And I think it's best maybe to begin, and we've discussed this in the pod, but it might be a good refresher. When you first heard about the plot of this season, and I'll run it down right now, basically, what we learned when the trade started reporting on it was that Castle Rock season 2 was going to fold in Misery's Annie Wilkes, who is going to be played by Lizzie Kaplan, who's a lot younger than Kathy Bates. And she was also going to have a daughter who was 16 years old. That's one storyline. And then we are also going to get the Merrill clan. Pot Merrill, who is featured in The Sundog and mentioned in other stories. And then Ace Merrill from Stand By Me and Needful Things.
Yeah.
Another, you know, presence who's felt throughout any Castle Rock story. Also, we get Jerusalem's Lot, which was hinted at in the first season. Mm-hmm. We didn't know the nature of what Jerusalem's Lot would be, except for the fact that there were Somali refugees who were building businesses there. And like, and the way that I read that was like, oh, the town was decimated and immigrants are sort of rebuilding
exactly.
the town.
Exactly. That's how I kind of felt.
Obviously, we'll get to it, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
No.
So, so basically, we heard that it was going to encompass all of those different storylines. And we also knew that Tim Robbins from Shawshank Redemption was going to return to the King World
which
as Pot Merrill.
Like a spiritual nod to like Bill Skarsgård being in it and Sissy Spacek being in it in the first season.
Yeah, so,
which
it's
was
like
nice,
it's stunt casting in a way that works.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And so when you first read about that, what was your initial reaction?
Now, it should be noted that both Randall and I have to cover news, entertainment news. For our respective, you know, publications. And I think the first thing, I was so taken back that I usually jump right at the story.
Yeah.
And the first thing I did was text. Mm-hmm. I was just like, can you fucking believe this?
Yeah.
Because it just seems so unnecessary. I mean, like, even when you look at it from a text wise, let's just say that king, you know, originally had this destined to be where Annie Wilkes was going to go. It is so insane to think that this character that has nothing to do with Castle Rock would just somehow land in Castle Rock.
Yeah.
It's too perfunctory. It's too like Super Mario All-Stars.
Yep.
Like it's just, it's a little too greatest hits for me.
Yeah.
And it's also like really, you know, it made me curious because the first thing I thought of was, oh, well, maybe they're going to do what we thought they were going to do in the first season and jump around in time.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll go back to the 70s or like, you know, if this is going to be young Annie Wilkes, then maybe it's a prequel because by all, you know, considerations of what the first season set out to do, and this is something I have in my review on Consequence of Sound, it worked within the confines of the Stephen King's established universe.
Yep.
Like Alan Pangborn was older because this takes place in modern times.
Yeah.
So everything that, you know, happened in all of King's books still existed. That's not the case with Annie Wilkes.
Let's
here
hold
now.
Off on that though, because that is a huge discussion point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, but I do want to say, I think this is a good time to bring it up. You know, I was looking at a lot of comments from our listeners. Thank you for those, by the way. We love hearing them, even when you disagree with us.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people were like, man, I hated the first season. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, you guys love the first season.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll like the second season since Mike didn't like the second season. And so, and that might be true. And I wouldn't begrudge you that. But I think what I always try to tell people is, I think if you listen to our episodes, we all kind of soured on the first season by the end of it.
Yeah.
But story-wise, mm-hmm. I think I always respected the show, and I still do, especially in the early going, for doing something that I found truly unique, which was taking King IP, telling original stories within it,
mm-hmm.
while also embodying a similar tone,
mm-hmm.
Sort of similar horror nods and characterizations.
Like, it's like what I said, it's like you hook them with familiarity and you win them over with originality.
Yeah.
And that's a great premise.
And like, I would say that their storytelling got way too convoluted too many dots weren't connecting. I still forget that there was like those like Rory Culkin's character in the first Castle Rock season. Like what?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when you think about those characters and it's like, you could have done all of this without them and you could have found other ways. Like there was too much going on.
Ultimately what happened in that first season that worried me about coming into this second season is that they tried to do what Stephen King does great, which is tell short stories within the larger narrative.
Yes.
Which is something that he does in every one of his stories.
Yes.
It's his hallmark. It's his
especially
strength.
Especially in Castle Rock stories.
And especially in the Castle Rock stories where you can hear about the little things that happened either in the past or in the present or whatever.
Yep.
And they have a hard time contending with that. They, mm-hmm. they, you know, in the first season, they have some real, you know, winners. I mean, I would argue that their short story, their bottle episode, The Queen, is arguably the best part of that whole entire run. But does it really fit in with that? No. I mean, Ruth, who is Sissy Spacek, her narrative fizzles out by the end and it doesn't really do anything and it doesn't resolve with the larger narrative. And So going into the second season and finding out that they're going to be doing, you know, so much.
Yeah.
There was a fear of mine going like, oh God, they might have bit off way more than they can chew. While also maybe, and again, we haven't talked to, you know, Sam Shaw and Dustin Thomason since last year, and I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but the idea of Annie Wilkes being put in this, and based on how the story plays out, it felt as if Hulu saw the first season, saw that they were like, well, look, it made a mark. You got the Stephen King IP. You need to lean a little bit too much into it. I haven't read Sundog.
Nobody knows who Alan Pangborn is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Who's this Pop Merrill? Oh, yeah. The Sundog? What's that? It sounds like a Soundgarden song.
You need
song.
Someone people know.
Yeah, and so for me, that's the first initial thought that I thought of when I first saw the headline and saw that Misery was going to be it. And then the two big words that everyone called it in the first season came up to mind, fan fiction.
Yeah, and that's... Whereas the first season, in my opinion, is not fan fiction.
I don't think it is. No,
yeah, I thought it was an original story within the world, which to me was such an intriguing approach to IP. Because we have to operate in IP now.
You know?
It's just how it works. Like Fargo is the one I always go to as a perfect example of how you can do this right.
Totally.
You know? And for me, I think my first feeling was excitement. I think not because... It was just my gut reaction was Ace Merrill.
Yes.
Pop Merrill.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I love those characters.
Like, that's enough for me.
Yeah. Like, I love those characters, and I feel like there is more to be there, especially if you set it, you know, before the events of The Sundog and Needful Things, mm-hmm. Which, if you want to, you know... There's things that happen in those books, no spoilers, that you know, it would make it really difficult to keep telling the story afterwards. But I'll just say that, like, if you said it before then, I would love to see sort of a standalone horror story that interweaves their arcs, you know, and even Jerusalem's Lot, like what does it look like post-vampire? Like, I think this is what's so funny is, there's almost this expectation, and we'll talk more about this in a minute, and I'll just bring this up briefly, that we're supposed to just be totally cool with season two completely disregarding King history and lore.
And that's my biggest gripe.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I'm trying to be cool about that, but I'm not. Like,
no.
I mean, I understand that there are more worlds than these, and that the King world embodies many planes and universes, but... And this is, we'll save that conversation because I have so many thoughts. But I'll say that my initial reaction was excitement because I thought about like, wow, that's really exciting. But my thing was, I started just like, my brain started breaking down because I'm like, wait a minute. Annie Wilkes. Okay. Lizzie Kaplan. Wait, so that means it's a younger Annie Wilkes. So it's like a prequel. Oh, okay. But wait, then Ace Merrill wouldn't be like, because they had initially cast Garrett Hedlund.
Yeah.
It's like 40 or 35 or something. So I'm just like, okay, and then Pop Merrill's, you know,
Tim
the same
Robbins,
age. Yeah, the same age he is in The Sundog and everything. And I'm just like sitting here going, this timeline, like these don't match up at all. And I just don't get it. And then I find out that Annie has a 16-year-old daughter. And I'm like, okay, so they're really playing fast and loose with this, you know? Whereas, you know, with Alan Pangborn, I don't feel like it was, it wasn't slavishly
devoted.
It was
natural.
Yeah, we didn't hear about, like, all of his past exploits that we read about in the books. But
although it was hinted.
It was hinted.
It was totally hinted.
But this
yeah.
felt like a natural, like, I could buy that this is Alan Pangborn, like, at this time. What this, I guess, like, the more I thought and the more, because, you know, I would write up other casting notices or we discussed it on the pod. It just kind of became abundantly clear that this was going to operate outside of the Stephen King universe, or, well, I'm sorry, within the Stephen King universe, but outside of his narratives.
Yeah.
And that to me is where I think this gets a little bit weird.
Yeah.
And I think the phrase fan fiction came to mind because it just sounded to me like I didn't find a good reason for you to de-age Annie and specifically use her for this story. Like, if it's about her coming in between what they called the warring clans or whatever, like this Somali community, the Merrill community, Castle Rock versus Jerusalem's Lot, throwing Annie in there, and it's like you said, it's like an executive said, you got to get a bigger name in there. But the thing is, the whole season is really built around her.
I know.
And so it really, I guess, so like my excitement initially of just being like, wow, I know those names, and I am excited to see what other stories could be told, just kind of turned into, but if they're decrying, like, the whole thing is like, this feels like a house of cards to me. Like, once you start pulling away certain aspects of a character.
Yep.
So, like, if this is Annie, like, we know a lot about her past in the book. We know that she's basically she is a serial killer.
She is.
And
she goes from clinic to clinic. Yeah, and house.
She's a quote-unquote angel of mercy in that she kills sick people, but then she also kills babies and stuff like that, and also killed her family or members of her family and her neighbors. Like, there's a lot going on there. She is a sadistic killer.
Mm-hmm.
And then now she has a 16-year-old daughter, and I'm like, that does not track.
No.
And also the idea that she would just be kind of running around the country does not track. And I guess for me, I started to just think more, and I was like, we're taking too many pieces of Annie's history away. And also the whole question of who is Paul Sheldon in this world?
I know. And then they keep kind of teasing that in this too.
Which is weird.
Which makes no fucking sense.
I know.
And it becomes at that point just almost like pandering.
Right.
Where you're like, oh, there's the wheelchair. You know how that's going to factor.
And there's this.
When, though? Did it happen already? Is it going to happen? Because, I mean, if we're going by the narrative, and that opens up a bunch of questions, because it's like, all right, so since we're kicking all narrative all together now, is this after Misery? Did she already do Paul Sheldon and she survived in that storyline?
Right,
I mean, it seems so unnecessary.
Right. So, like, I think now's a good time to talk about the use of the IP here, and then we can talk about the specifics of the story, because I want to talk about Annie and the Sheldon connection as it stands in these three. We're here talking about the three episodes, first three episodes that have been released, by the way.
They're called Let the River Run, New Jerusalem, and Ties That Bind.
Yeah, so spoilers for those episodes. We've seen the first five.
We have.
Have you watched all of five?
I've watched the first. I have, actually, though I need to rewatch five because it was very late.
Yeah, I was actually a little sleepy during five as well.
Yeah.
But we're talking about the first three. And so I feel like that's out of a 10-episode season. I think we know where. I mean, like, we have an idea
of
where
idea.
It's going.
But to be fair, based on that first season, who the fuck knows?
Who the fuck knows?
Because
so,
I thought I had things figured out by episode 9, and then all of a sudden 10 just went.
Ugh.
Yeah.
And okay. So I guess, okay, so here's the deal. To elaborate on what I was saying, we have characters who exist within the King universe in towns that exist within the King universe. But so I did an Easter egg post for AV Club, and I'm going to be updating it throughout the season. Trying to explain this shit is really confusing.
It's very confusing.
Which is like why I find it very bizarre that people seem to be enjoying it, because and that's not to say you shouldn't. I say love what you love. But for me, it's like it's so weird and convoluted. And the idea that we're supposed to just so readily accept that these are characters we know who are also not those characters is so strange to me.
And it goes into kind of what we always make fun of with like the Dark Tower Easter eggs,
yeah.
Where before in the first season, there were these like kind of lived in references that
mm-hmm.
made sense, you know, like when you see the headlines that were all over the warden's desk in the first season that had to do with all the strange doings that were going on in Castle Rock, and knowing that Pangborn was involved. And we know that
mm-hmm.
we know that Pangborn because we've read those books.
Right.
You know, it was tangential to the story, but it was a good Easter egg in the sense that we know that they were embedded in the history of the show. They informed the town. It made sense. We could, if you wanted to know the history and you wanted to go even deeper, you could read the books.
Yeah.
You don't have that in this season.
No.
Because now it's all like this sort of like I said before, it's a very pandering Easter egg now, where it's just like they're using it for the sake of using it. Like, we had this discussion on text the other night, just like even the number 19 feels like it means no value anymore, because it just seems so like, well, people know 19, so let's just go throw that out there at this point. And even like the little they're like little like cheeky nods, like, you know, the kids that, you know, that she goes out and plays
with,
they're
like all
one of them's names
me.
Like Chance as like
Chance,
Gloria LaChance, and then Vera instead
Timothy
of Vern
and Vera, so yeah, it's Vern, Ted, and then Gordy LaChance.
So it's just like these little things that you're like, all right, so we have these established stories, so we're just going to take them and then recalibrate them and then subvert them. Like, that's not interesting to me anymore.
They have, like, so, like, here's just an example. In episode three, Chance shows up and says, want to go find a body.
Exactly.
They go look for one, but here's the thing. That body has no bearing on the story.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an excuse to do a scene with the kids.
Yep.
and be like, hey, you remember Stand By Me? It's not like they're using the fabric of like what Stand By Me was really about to like deepen something or add context to something. Like when you bring Pangborn in, you bring in the weight of somebody who's seen all of Castle Rock. You're not replicating something that was in a book and like you're being like, hey, remember this? It's not like Pangborn had a scene where he met a shopkeeper and was like, oh, you reminded me of someone, you know?
And then you imagine if that
I know,
was the
but
case?
That's what this season feels
it
like.
It does. And that wasn't the case in the first season at all.
And so I think like a good way to look at this is I look at Annie. Let's talk about Annie for a moment, because we meet Annie in the first episode and she's in a hospital, she's stealing meds, and
Lizzie Caplan is doing her very best to basically do kind of an off-Broadway version of Kathy Bates's role in the
I don't dislike it as much as you do. I think she's compelling, but it is like broad.
Yeah.
You know? So but we see her with her daughter, and we see them growing up and driving around, and they're singing Carly Simon, a song which I think was chosen simply because it has the words New Jerusalem in it.
Yeah.
And they're trying to find their laughing place, which is their New Jerusalem, which is like your heaven. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
well, little did he know that there's a town called Jerusalem's Lot that we're going to be talking about.
It's wild. And so they're going through town. And then when they're driving through Castle Rock, they get into a car accident and they end up having to stay in the town, and they end up staying in cabins that are owned by the Merrill family.
Yeah.
So, but I guess let's talk about this version of Annie. She's probably, I mean, I think they're trying to sell her as being like 40 or so, but I don't buy that.
I think it's got to be mid-30s, maybe.
Lizzie resonates as early to mid-30s.
Yeah.
Having a 16-year-old daughter is wild. It's hard for me to buy her as a mom. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I think she's a great actress, but in this instance, she just feels really miscast to me.
Yeah.
And it's
so much that's going on.
Yeah.
That doesn't need to be.
But we do find out she looks herself up online, and it's like she's wanted by the FBI for murder. We know that. And
so she has an established, you know, past already. Which she should, considering based on the lore.
And so we see, and it was a younger version of her, because the photo of her is like a much younger version. And the piece opens. The whole series opens with her bloody running through the woods holding a box. And I like really zoomed in, and I think I see what it says. I think it says the ravening angel is what's written on the side of the.
It was either that or the something like the runaway angel or something.
The runaway angel. Yeah, it might be. Yeah. It looked
which
like
I thought
ravening.
Maybe could have been a book that, you know, or something.
Yeah. But. So it's me as that struck me as a misery, like a misery type reference. I'm like, well, that could maybe be the name of a romance novel, especially
exactly,
runaway
yeah.
angel. I think it said ravening. I like really tried to look at it, and that is a phrase that has like spiritual tones, I guess. But but we see her kind of take this box with her down to the water, and the box like moves at the end, so there's something living inside the box, which I don't know what, but because we don't see that in the first three episodes.
Baby Cujo,
maybe. I would love that. God. Just bring him in, why not? And what if she just pulls a little baby Saint Bernard? God, I'm laughing. So but what that hints towards to me, that it seems like that's paper. That's a file box that would be in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a few other nods once she gets a part-time job being a nurse in, I believe it's Salem's Lot, right? Like that's where she's at? Or is it Castle
It's a rural
Rock?
Hospital outside of Salem's
Lot. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
And so, but when she's there, we get a few other misery nods or things that would ostensibly point towards misery. We get a
wheelchair
rolling in, and then she sees this spirit of a man who is dressed like in a suit.
Which
and
could
stuff.
Conceivably be her father.
It could be.
Yeah.
And
because her mother is cast in this show. So they are going to be doing, you know, flashbacks of, you know, some variety there.
Yeah. And so but the thing is, when that figure shows up, if you listen to the sound design, it's click clack typewriter keys. And you hear in all the voices that swirl around her, you hear the phrase, did you like it? Which makes me think that it's like it reminds me of a Paul Sheldon type situation.
Yes.
But the man is much older, I think, or he reads as older, the ghost that she sees, than Paul Sheldon would have been. So, but the thing is, did she do this thing with, because clearly Joy doesn't know about it, and Joy is 16.
No.
The vibe I get is that it happened before Joy was born.
And we also see in the beginning that Joy has been with her for a while, mm-hmm. because, you know, they're singing the same song. She's yep. younger, and yep. then she's older, and then now she's a teen, and she just wants to hang out with friends. And so you assume that, like, all right, so she's been at every stop that she's been. She's been oblivious to the fact that yeah. her mother is, like, stealing meds and also killing all these folks.
Well, I don't know if there are all these folks. Like, the FBI thing just says murder. So it might just be this one murder, maybe, that of this thing that, because she's haunted by something, why wouldn't she be haunted by all the other people she killed?
Unless it's assuming that she killed Paul Sheldon. She survived, or like there's a turn here where Paul Sheldon died and she lived.
Right. And that's, I think, that's at least where I'm at, mm-hmm. is what I'm assuming happened, I guess. And, but you know what what this does to me is it creates this cognitive dissonance. It's like, I feel like I've traveled through time or something.
Yeah.
And I'm having two different memories about the same thing.
Exactly.
You know, it's like something happened two different ways and I've got both memories in my head and it's driving me crazy.
That's
very Dark Tower. Like, it's like Jake when he has memories of his death, but then he's alive.
Well, hey, maybe it was supposed to be a Dark Tower 4D experience that they were planning to do for the second season.
Well, let me just say this. I think that might be an interesting thing to happen for a character. I don't want to feel that way as a viewer. I'm like almost, and so I guess this is what I get to is they're toying and like hinting that a thing that we know about from the books might have happened in the world of this. I'm literally holding my head right now because
I'm
like,
or it's as simple as that. This is trying to suppose that she killed Paul Sheldon and lived
when she was like 22 years old.
Which and even then it's just like. It's just really frustrating because this is clearly still of the world from the first season. They make references to the first season in, I believe, the third episode, I believe.
A character from the first season shows up in the fourth episode.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So but in the third episode, they mentioned that the warden's body died and they didn't find the head and everything. So this still exists in the first season. In that first season, they mentioned how, you know, there was the body that was found in the 60s and stuff like that, or the 50s. And they mentioned the fact that Cujo was, you know, there was the dog. You see the newspaper clippings of Needful Things. So all these like elaborated works that happened, you know, did happen in the right times that they're supposed to.
Yep.
So all of a sudden they're just going to kick that idea, this pre-established history, and then just drag in another character and then fudge that history. I mean, to their credit, if they're going to choose any character to do that to, it makes sense for Annie Wilkes because she has nothing really tied to, you know, to the overall, you know, Castle Rock arc.
Right.
Even so, it's really fucking maddening and confusing for those that are going to be coming into the show that A, either know of the story, or B, are really fucking know the story. So it's kind of a lose-lose situation altogether.
Well, that's how I feel is like if you're coming in fresh and you don't know Misery, then maybe it works. But then why all these references to Misery?
Yeah, I mean, I hope by episode 7, you know, they get a really hunky new doctor that comes into Jerusalem's lot named Lewis Creed.
I know,
you know,
right?
And his whole family moves into town also.
Well, there are Pet Cemetery nods
there
in
are.
This
oh,
as well.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
It's like, I guess my thing is, and then you look at Ace, and I look at this version of Ace. And what I see is, you know, a guy with an attitude, kind of a shit kicker. Yeah, that could be Ace.
Yeah.
But I see nothing else that resonates with the Ace that I've read in the books.
Yeah.
Pop Merrill makes more sense.
I think Pop Merrill's pretty fair.
But they make him much more sympathetic here
than
they do in the Sundog. Yeah. And the Sundog, like, he's not a total villain. Like, he's humanized really well in that book. But he's really selfish and really shitty and really... And really kind of, what's what I'm looking for, like, underhanded in the Sundog. Whereas here, he's so framed through the fact that he's, like, terminally ill, and he's got these kids that he really cares about. You know, he's got these Somali refugees that he adopted, and they grew up alongside Ace and Chris. And Chris is a character created for the show, Ace's brother. But, these are characters, overall, I can buy this.
A soldier who has guilt.
He was a soldier and a whole thing. You know. It feels, and that whole soldier storyline just feels grafted on from another thing, you know?
Yeah.
This, I can't help but shake that, well, I mean, it's not that I have to, you could take all of these characters and it could not be Annie and it could not be Ace and it could not be Pop and the story would work.
I know.
This is my problem. There is no reason why Annie Wilkes should be in the story why Ace Merrill should be in this story, why Jerusalem's Lot should be in this story. Because Jerusalem's Lot, if we're going to get to it, like, the Marston house is there,
yep.
But it doesn't appear that vampires were ever there. It appears that witches were there, because that's what everyone says. Mm-hmm. They say that the history of this town is witches, yeah. Which then Pop calls Satanists. And there's no mention of vampires. And then once we actually do see Ace become, you know, reanimated,
yeah.
he's not a vampire.
Which could have been such an easy thing for them to have
yeah.
done.
He's you know, something else. And he kills people by hitting him in the head with a hammer and then transforms them into something in a bathtub.
Yeah.
Like,
and that recalibration of things is, and maybe it's just because we're so embedded and invested in this
yeah,
lore now.
I think about that too.
I just can't do it.
Yeah.
It's just, it doesn't make sense to me for me. And it's also really frustrating, especially because I sound like a fucking broken record, but it goes back to the promise of the first season. Like, if you are going to be, you know, reverent to the source material, why fracture that? This, you know,
and it is so fractured.
It's
not like they
fractured.
Changed small things. They are just, they had a story they wanted to tell, and they have molded and smooshed
yeah.
Stephen King figures into those different molds.
Yep.
And that's what I have an issue with. The only thing that that says that this is Annie Wilkes is her performance,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that
well,
she
it's
is
convenient
a nurse
that she's a nurse, and then they could be put in the hospital thing.
But does she even need to be in a hospital?
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, and that's yeah. what I was wondering. It's like, is the hospital narrative even that paramount to what's going on?
And the
here?
Pill addiction and all this stuff. It's like there's all these things happening, but Annie's story here revolves around like this feud that she's developed with Ace and then with her daughter,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the fact that she murders Ace at the beginning of the first episode and then, you know, buries it, discovers the Marston house, doesn't know what's happening. And then, starts losing it a little bit. And then Joy ties her up, which Jesus Christ, like
narrative is
it's
arguably
so
the weakest of the whole season. It's unnecessary. It's, to show another side of life, I guess, to Castle
yeah,
Rock.
But
it's not even really doing that either.
Right. We'll get there in a moment, like when we get more granular with the episode. But I guess like my overall point here when I say all this stuff is that this to me is one of the laziest, worst uses of IP that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because I understand we have to use IP now. And I understand that this is a show that is about, you know, Stephen King's world. And I'm all about using the world. And asking questions like what happened to this character, or what if we slightly changed, because it's not like in every different universe within King's like many worlds, you know, like like in the Dark Tower books, when there are these different universes, it's not like they're wildly different.
No,
like if you think about in Wizard and Glass, like when they stumble upon the world of the Stand, the things that are different is like different types of cola,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Different sports teams.
Well, to borrow a word that you just said, granular. It's very granular.
Yeah.
You know, it's not
but
these
here,
seismic
it's like,
changes.
It's
where
literally the book Misery does not matter. We are telling a different story, but we're using this character's mannerisms and name and a few details from her life. And so to me, and you know, what's wild is like, you guys probably think that we're really hating on this. It's like, I don't hate the show.
No, I don't hate this
show. I think the show is fine.
There's still something that really, you know, look, I said in the review, like, it's still gorgeously shot.
Yeah.
It's still impeccably, you know, scored, and, you know, like the cinematography is just wonderful.
Acting's good.
The shot selections are great.
Tim Robbins is awesome.
Tim Robbins is phenomenal in it. But it's just, to me, it just seems as if this really did, they did get strong-armed into doing like a variety of different things, because when you even just look at the overall narrative itself and you're trying to figure out like, what are they trying to accomplish this season? It's really murky, and you really have to kind of pivot in one direction to really kind of see where it could be. And that wasn't the case last season. You know, the whole Shawshank thing was a really great spine to, you know, even just the thematic connections of that, with
yeah.
that with that thing, what it said about the past, what it said about our own demons, what it said about our own id. This season, it's like, okay, what are they trying to say? Like, is there a parallel between what's going on with Pop and what's going on with Annie? Like, it seems like there's just so much playing around with the past and also the present. in clumsy ways
that
wasn't being done in the first season. And the first season wasn't really, you know, perfected either. But in this one, it's really fucking crazy. It's like as if someone took Doc Brown's time machine and just was like, you know, you had like six different people in the backseat of a DeLorean, even though there's no backseat. I understand that. But if their voice is going, no, let's go here. Let's go here. Let's go there. I mean, in one episode alone, you get like multiple flashbacks to like maybe like, you know, a recent present and then all the way to 1994 and then all the way back. It's just like, holy shit.
That was annoying.
It's fucking crazy how pretzeled this is.
I know. And I guess thematically, like if you're thinking about it, it's like, I think about thematically there were themes about family and about faith and about you know, small town life and things like that, returning to a place, you know. These are all King themes.
Absolutely.
And those were all in the first one. The second season, like I think it's a noble effort and I think it's interesting, but there's really like a huge immigration spine to
Absolutely.
This story,
which goes into the xenophobia of Salem's Lot, which is they're using that source material.
But at the same time, like Salem's Lot wasn't really a story about immigration, was it? Like
it was
you
more
can
about
read
xenophobia,
that.
For sure.
Yeah, it was about xenophobia, but it's like
and change.
It's
and
like King, like immigration isn't a theme that is dominant in King's work, so it doesn't necessarily feel like a King story. You know what I mean? It's like, and so I guess that's what I'm saying too. Is like thematically, it even feels like I don't know why this story is being told in this world.
Yeah,
and so it's not that I don't like the story; it's just that none of this feels like what the show was billed as and promised as.
No.
And so I guess my problem, like overall, is I find this use of IP to be cynical, lazy, and frankly bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think that's like what I keep coming back to is I just was saying when I was watching the screeners before it premiered, I was like, who is this for?
Yeah.
But it's getting good reviews.
It really is.
People seem to like it, and I don't begrudge that. It's like, cool. I want to talk to people about, like, what is it you really like about it?
Well, Sammy, actually, my girlfriend, we've been watching the screeners together. She put up a good point, was like, this feels more like American Horror Story than the last season did.
It really
and
does.
And it really does.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's why. I mean, it's very pulpy.
Yep.
It's pulpy to a point that is obscene.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, the ending of the first episode with the way that she, you know, quote unquote, kills Ace Merrill
with the ice
so
cream scoop.
Insane.
And you know that's a nod a little bit to the book, because she makes him like an ice cream sundae.
Yeah.
And which is stupid. But,
yeah. I mean, again, it's just like these little sort of, they're taking bits of source material, and what used to be kind of clever is now this over the top and in your face. But that scene in particular just made me realize, like, oh, they're really trying to just go for like the moment that they can talk, that people might be able to talk about or to kind of, you know, scare on a more genre surface level.
And American Horror Story is not King. That's not King horror. You
no.
know, that is like campy, over the top gore horror. Like, I do not like American Horror Story, and I guess like the thing is it's
even
overstuffed.
The singing with like Carly Simon in the beginning, like that seems like something so out of like a Ryan Murphy show,
right? And but in the same way that the whole problem with American Horror Story is it's wildly unfocused.
Oh,
those seasons,
beyond, yeah.
It's like you get whiplash watching those seasons, and there's value in it. I know I didn't hate the second season. I know some people who like other seasons, but
well, that's a season that includes what? Aliens, Nazis, zombies, ghosts, Germans.
And you could cut the entire alien subplot in particular, and nothing would change in that season. But it's like for me, that I'm getting that vibe, but I got that vibe in the first season a little bit too, but I got it more so here where there is too much going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and that's what drives me crazy. But I think what angers me about this show is just like, it's like someone said, you can tell whatever story you want. You just have to name characters after Stephen King characters and have them act in ways that are recognizable to viewers, i.e. Lizzie Kaplan's performance, which, you know, some people seem to really like it. I don't hate it. I think that she's finding some different shades to it, but it is a fierce imitation. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a fully totally realized character. It's an imitation.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and that's why, if they're trying to strive to show some depth and she's the source of that, I'm not getting it.
Right. And also, like, you know, most people just, I feel like this is it's the film version of Kathy Bates, who is the center, who is sort of the focal point, the touch point for this version of the character, because it's like, I feel like they want us to, like, why make her your main character. Like, she's a serial killer, yeah. at least as we know her. But the like, she cuts off a guy's foot because she wants him to write a book for her, you know? It's like, but then you make her the main character, and it's clear to some degree that we're supposed to be rooting for her.
And that's why I think, like,
right?
The rule, yeah, it is. And that for all those reasons, that's why I think, like, going back, even looking back in the first season, that's why I really liked Henry Deaver.
Yeah.
You know, because it was a character that wasn't canon. You know, it was a new character that was allowed.
Like a king character.
Exactly. And you were allowed to kind of graph that because there are no expectations tied to him.
Yeah.
You can just kind of create something, you know, out of the pages. And then the corollary characters, the corollary environments could allow us to kind of embellish those king, you know, motifs. And you can't do that here because we have expectations of this killer. We know that she's a serial killer. We know that she, you know, she has some sort of past. We know what her motivations are inevitably going to be. Even when she's just like, you know, at the end of the third episode, when she realized that, you know, her daughter is, you know, where her daughter is going to end up,
yeah.
like, you know, inevitably based on her past. These aren't revelations because we already fucking know that. And like, so I almost wish there was some sort of like rule for the writers of the show to have been like, all right, we can't use like principal characters
yeah.
from the King universe to be the leads of this show.
Right.
Because it doesn't make sense.
But
like,
also,
that's what we're trying to do.
Just like what you're saying, though, it's like you say we already know these things. And but what I kind of hate that the show does is like, or do you?
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
like, and I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, it's so bizarre.
Well, and that's, it's kind of like going with like the Bates Motel thing did. Did you, I mean,
well, I never watched Bates Motel.
Well, I didn't watch it, but I know all of the like the little like twists in that. And, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched all of Bates Motel or anything, but like, you know, it turns out like Marion Crane, who's like the famous,
yeah.
you know, the famous person who dies in the shower. Like, she doesn't die. No, she lives. And it's actually her sister. And it's like this play around
uh-huh.
with like the source material there. And I guess that worked because
but
you're sticking strictly to that psycho story. It wasn't like a town that you were going through. It was literally just like, you know.
But also in that sense, it was like they started with him when they were young and they were carving a new path for
exactly,
him.
Yeah.
They're not teasing us like. It's not like they started with an older Norman Bates, like who was ostensibly the same age as Psycho,
yeah.
and they were trying to like tease us as to whether or not he killed Marion in the shower.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's like did he or didn't he do it?
Yeah,
that's it's like whereas if you start with him younger and you're like, okay, he hasn't done this yet, I'm gonna tell a new story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then that's a little bit different. If you give me Annie Wilkes when she's young and you focus on her story, but it takes place in the universe of Misery, but you show me decisions she made where it veers into something else, I'll buy that.
Yeah.
But you're literally sticking me in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're sticking me in the middle of it, and you're asking me to let go of everything I know from the book, but also hold on to it because
exactly.
we're going to make a bunch
yeah.
of references to it.
Yeah.
See, I get mad about this because yeah. it feels reckless to me.
And it is
reckless.
People
are probably laughing at how annoyed I am at this, but it's like, and I wouldn't blame you, but it's like, I just, to me, it's baffling story decisions. It's baffling to me.
Well, it's baffling, and it also makes me realize or think or theorize or assume, whatever you want to call it, that they have no idea what they're doing either. You know, and that they're constantly just like, you know, pivoting around whatever they can, you know, based on whatever source material they can glean upon.
But I don't want to believe that because we talked to them and they were cool.
I agree.
They seem smart.
And,
yeah.
I don't really think that, but by not like by, you know, pulling punches and, you know, pivoting around things, I assume that they don't have really a control on their story. And like, that's, you know, and that's only because of the assumptions that I have based on whatever source material they're using. So
yeah.
I know it's like, it's almost like the IP is coming back to haunt them.
I know.
But maybe just for us, because clearly everyone is like digging it so far. So like, you know,
I feel like, well, yeah, I mean, and the thing is we are so immersed in this, but at the same time, I guess I just laugh. Cause I think like, I feel like this would be least confusing for us, maybe, because like we at least understand that the King universe can exist on multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like I would be so confused if I were a casual viewer and I'm just like, so wait, this like, is this before or after the movie Misery, you know, or the book
yeah.
Misery?
I mean, but think of it again. It goes into like the pulpy angle. Like, just think about just like the bare beats of this,
yeah.
this story. You know,
yeah.
you have a crazy psychotic nurse. Ooh, mystery drama. There's a lot of like base level stuff to kind of hook in people that are just coming in as casual viewers.
Yeah.
But then again, like, you know, this is an age where we're just consumed and over consumed with media, or just inundated with media, that why would someone want to just pull into something that at face value looks like something that requires, you know, some sort of like knowledge or prior knowledge to it? Because like, if I saw Castle Rock, and I'm trying to assume that I'm not a Stephen King reader,
yeah.
if I saw that and I said, oh, Stephen King's Castle Rock, I would just assume that you would have to know like about Stephen King's lore.
Yeah.
And I know that people have had that sort of those hesitations going into this show because I've had to tell them like, no, you don't need to know Stephen King to do it.
Especially with this season.
especially with that season. But again, I think you could have had a really cool medium. And I think that the first season definitely hits on that a little bit more where you can be the diehard Stephen King scholar and also be the casual viewer and still get a great story. With this season, I don't really know. I think almost like you're better off being a casual viewer than a Stephen King scholar.
I know. I guess like the vibe I get is like, I see, it's like people think it's, I don't know. How do I phrase this? I'm like stumbling, but Stephen King fans that I know are like, this season rules. And I'm just like, and I'm sitting here going like, is it because like you understand that his works like apparently, you know, there's all these alternate dimensions within his work. And because you recognize that, it's like, that's what makes it really good. Like you get that. So you're just like, oh yeah, I get it. It's like a different alternate universe with all these characters. And I'm just like, but for me, I'm like, that completely negates what I would find interesting about this show. Mm-hmm. And I'm having so much trouble understanding what it is that people really like about it. Because it's, in my opinion, too, I guess let's talk about it in storytelling wise.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mess.
It's a mess.
It's a mess. It is all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have pretty much talked about how there are just like things going everywhere. I mean, and it's really hard to kind of see where this is trying to go or where it wants to go. I mean, that was the first thing that we texted having watched the screeners was just like, I you were hesitant to actually to want to be critical.
Yeah, I was like, I want to watch.
I want to see where it goes.
Yeah.
Having seen 5 episodes, I still am, you know, kind of like, I don't know.
I feel that way too. It's like, I guess the funny thing for me was like, I remember when I was watching episode two, I think at the beginning when she came out of the Marston house.
Yeah.
I think I was like, okay, maybe I can be into this. Like,
yeah.
I think I was getting on its level a little bit. And I was like, this could be kind of cool. Maybe because I feel like they're toying with the Salem's Lot lore a little bit and things like that. Like I thought, but that was also when I still didn't know a lot about the universe. And I was like, okay, so this is the Annie from the books, you know, mm-hmm. and that is the Ace from the books, and they're going to bring in the vampires to some degree. And maybe I can just enjoy it on a pulp level, you know, was kind of what I was hoping. But then I think it was during the third episode when Joy tied her up and I was like, I remember watching that. I was by myself in my apartment. I was texting you guys going, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, this show is crazy. And I think I said, I was like, how are there 7 more episodes after this? Her daughter has tied her up to the bed.
Yeah.
And and that whole sequence was more Gerald's game than Misery.
It was,
because she breaks the glass and then,
everything. And she needs to try to escape and get out of it.
And then she's like so grotesquely covered in blood. And I'm just kind of like, this is nuts.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels nuts.
There's a lot that happens in the first 3 episodes that make me wonder if they're ever going to pump the brakes. Because honestly,
well,
there's
season 2.
Season 1, they definitely do. But there's just so much going on that it's almost exhausting to kind of keep up with. Because I mean, I've rewatched these episodes multiple times.
I have
so
too.
Like. And I'm still finding myself going like, oh, yeah, I guess. All right. So that was happening. Oh, interesting. Because they've just, you know, credit to Thomason and Shaw. But like they have a lot of story they want to tell. But like, fuck, just like parse it down a little bit and just like, you know, really kind of give it its weight and give its sort of girth there. And like, because like there's a lot of it that's so thin. Like the whole stuff with like Tim Robbins, like his arc is so thin right now.
It's
still
so thin.
You know, it's very brittle. And like the same with like the Smalleys. Like I feel like I don't know any of them.
No.
Even though you're supposed to, because there's clearly like some, you know, scenes with the dog when they're tying up one of his, you know, his adopted sons. And it's like, God, there's like some, like a lot of emotional gravitas that should be here in these earlier, in these scenes. But it's like the second or third episode. So like all these crazy things are happening. So I have to wonder that they're getting to a larger story, because if there's so much that they're rushing through in these first 3 episodes, there has to be something bigger.
I'll say when I was watching screeners, when I saw that spoiler alert for the nature of the 5th episode, but it's not a huge spoiler. I like screamed when I saw it was a flashback episode.
Yeah.
I was like, no, we don't have time for this. We do not have time for this. Like, keep moving forward. Like, you have to get, show me where you're going.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was like so annoyed. And then that's the last screener they sent us to. So it's like, I just want to burn through this because I am so curious to know where it's going.
Which is a good thing.
It is, but that's, it's a good, like, thing.
But it's also not,
I'm not enjoying
it. Like, I'm not sitting here going like, I can't wait what happens, like I do with Succession week to week. But,
right.
You know,
I just want to know what they're going to do.
And it's mostly to ease frustrations.
Yes.
It's not for curiosity's
because,
sake.
Like, if maybe it hits the end and they totally win me over and they're like, and I'm like, oh, it needed to be up.
Maybe it's
be
an inverse of the first season.
Maybe. I don't know. It's like, I'm okay with that. Like, I'll be like, okay, if you win me over in the end, I will eat my words, you know? I will say that I judged it too harshly too early, but watching five episodes and I you know, that's a lot, and I feel this way.
The one thing I will commend about this show still is just the visual world building is just incredible.
It is.
And
yeah.
It really does feel in line with what Darabont tried to create with, you know, Shawshank and The Mist and all. Still, I mean, when Annie walks out of the Marston house and sees the town below, I'm like, yes, that is exactly how it's supposed to look in Salem's Lot. And then or later on when she sees the house, or they see the house up there, because they're saying that, you know, they're heroin users and whatnot, so we should go check it out. The Marston house is at the top of the hill, and I was like, yes, this is exactly how I visualize it. Why can't we play in this world the right fucking way?
Yeah.
Like, why can't they bring the right toys to the sandbox and just fucking play in it in an accordingly way? Because there's so much history and so much, like, narrative that they could have used and leaned upon and built this story from that, as opposed to just fumbling the old narrative.
And now they're talking about witches?
Yeah, like, come on.
That's,
like,
not King,
no.
Dude. That's not King.
No.
Like, that is not... Like, I don't know. This is, I'm just getting bitchy about it, but
yeah,
it's,
but
like,
broadly, like, let's just, I mean, because I don't want to go too down the rabbit hole, because I will lose my mind with, like, other little details in here. But ultimately, I guess, you know, if we're speaking conclusively, like, do you still think there's, like, you know, opportunity for this medium?
Yeah, like, it's an anthology, so tell a new story. Maybe I'll be more interested next time. But what is it going to be next time?
I know.
It's going to be
Johnny
Smith driving Christine with Cujo by his side. Didn't we make all these jokes? Like,
we did. Well, we made that these jokes because they included, like, Jackie. Well, we included earlier on in the episode, but we included it in, like, last season when they, you know, threw in Jackie Torrance in there, because
God.
That was kind of the more insufferable notions or insufferable,
like, Jackie
facets
Torrance
of that.
Is this season?
It is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's, oh man, it's so funny to me. No, I just,
they,
like,
leaned into the worst part of the first season.
It's just gonna be like, oh no, you made a joke in our text there about, like, Carrie White, like, well, there's a new teacher in town.
Teacher.
It's Carrie White
and let's just say she's still angry with the students.
But the thing is, that's probably what will happen.
Yeah, and people will love it.
And they'll love it. I don't, this, see, it's like, this is I'm usually so positive, and I try to be so positive, and I try to be like, maybe it could be good, and, like, maybe I know it's, like, you know, I read the comments on Ivy Club occasionally, not a lot because it's so depressing, but it's like, but it's just, it's the same, it's people like neckbeardy complaints about like stuff from 10 years ago, like,
yeah,
like, who cares about Paris Hilton, you know? It's like,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, where it's like, no, we get there, we've been there. It's like saying Nickelback sucks. It's like, that
exactly
is, like, it's the oldest, move on. Like,
yeah,
like, find new things to get mad about. People are just mad about the same shit. And it's the same thing with just, like, everything's a remake these days. And it's like, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's been proven that we can have good remakes and we can use IP well. People, because it's such a necessity now, it's like in the old days, like when they would, if you made a porno in the 70s, they would give you all the money in the world, and they would just say, or like these producers, they give you all this money and they'd say, there has to be 20 minutes of sex in your movie, there has to be like 30 minutes of sex in your movie,
but
go do whatever you want, so they could just build stories around porn.
Yeah,
and a lot of really interesting movies came out in the 70s.
That was their IP, was the porn.
Yeah, and the IP was porn, where it was like, you have to include this stuff in there, but you can tell your own stories around it. And like Vinegar Syndrome, the distribution company, that's what they put out. They're like, all these really weird, interesting, like, exploitation movies. Like, a lot of interesting stuff came out of that. And so I feel like we're in a more mainstream version of that now, which is IP. It's like, people are finding ways to work with IP and tell interesting stories. I would say even in Marvel.
Well,
like, I'm not like a Marvel stan, but I like Marvel, and I do think they're finding ways to tell unique, interesting stories in several of those movies.
Well, I would say the same criticisms that are levied against Stranger Things, which I think does a great job with old IP.
Agree.
is being praised for this show.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with Stranger Things, people are always like, oh, this is just a regurgitation of blah, blah, blah.
That
like,
makes
but
me
it's
so
not,
mad.
Though. It's like total fucking, you we know, are the reintroduction.
We are the stands of
we
Stranger
are,
Things
we
in
are,
this
though.
Pod.
We absolutely
but
are.
But I do. I take such umbrage with people who act like that show is just a regurgitation of shit.
Yeah.
It like, that show to me it tells such, like, wonderful coming-of-age stories and also good horror and action stories.
And also
that,
tight narratives.
Yeah, and they always know how to draw upon iconography to enhance their own story.
Exactly.
And that's what's important to me. Mm-hmm. And that's like what I feel like I'm missing in this show.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
And so I don't know. Let's talk about a few other things that we do like, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
So we're not total negative Nancy. So you've mentioned the cinematography. I agree. Like, the look of the town is great. The Marston House. When I was doing some research for my Easter eggs post, you know, I found that old quote from Salem's Lot, where they say the Marston House sits over the town like a ruined king,
and what it looks like.
Yeah, and that's like exactly how it yeah. looks in the show, and I love that.
Yeah.
But I guess like I also love Tim Robbins' performance. Mm-hmm. He has a scene in the fourth episode that I think is wonderful. It's the best acting on the show so far is in that scene. I think Paul Sparks is good casting for Ace, but as you see in this isn't a spoiler because you've seen the first three episodes, they kill him at the end of the first episode.
Yeah.
And then he's just a zombie.
He's Pascal.
He's Pascal, and he doesn't get to be Ace. Like, that's what, oh
yeah.
man, I'm like getting mad here because
like
you have a great character,
like,
and then you kill him.
You could have had the
Merrills
be the main character, because honestly, like, again, they were corollary characters for the most part in King's Bourke. So if you bring them as the main characters, fine. That's I'm okay with that. Or even if they were going to be, you know, supporting characters in this, that would be still more interesting than where they're being used now, because yeah, you like you're saying, like, they totally waste the essence of those characters.
Yes, like, you just turn Ace into yeah. a zombie.
But
it's like, and he's although it's just like so weird because he's not a vampire, but he's not a Pet Cemetery's kind
he's
of zombie
not.
Because
he's still normal.
He's
his
like
teeth
a,
are
yeah,
back to normal.
Yeah,
everything.
He's still like a human.
Mm-hmm.
So it reminds me more of I was writing in my Easter eggs post. It's like it strikes me more as like desperation, like before they start like
yeah.
falling apart, and Tommyknockers, where it's like they're possessed. But they're still them, and
yeah.
they still retain like memories of their life. So, but it's I think what they're more so going for is like Pet Cemetery, where they still retain memories, but they're wrong.
Yeah.
But the visual aspect is all off in that regard.
Yeah.
Like they brought Ace back as some sort of like weird boilerplate zombie, where it's like it's like almost something from all these different King works, but it's not any of them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and like that might be. I don't know. I feel like that might be a good description for this whole season.
I think that's a perfect description. I guess like looking in the positives though, like I mean, like the world building for me visually is still really the only saving grace I would say right now, because I'm not that intrigued with what's actually happening. Like I don't really care about. I mean, like the Merrill storyline could have been interesting, but as it is, it's not. Like,
right.
you know, it just seems to me that like they've already pretzeled that story to the point where. I don't know. I guess I'm waiting to see where they can take it to the next step on that. But
well,
even
like
then, it's not enough because there's no
yeah.
main protagonist for me to fucking latch onto.
Well, it's like, wasn't the fights was kind of between Ace and Abdi.
Yeah.
And then Ace is dead. So it's like, okay. And then now Ace is concerned with building an army of zombies. So... what's up with the Somali storyline?
Yeah.
And so then the Somali storyline is pivoted to Tim Robbins' relationship to his kids,
mm-hmm.
which is cool, but it feels disconnected from
yeah.
everything else, you
mm-hmm.
know? And I like, I forget her name, the woman who plays, is the doctor's name Nadia?
Yes, it's
yeah.
It's Nadia Omar. So
yeah.
it's Yusra Warsama.
And she's great.
She's great.
I've
she's
seen
great.
Her in other stuff
yeah.
and she's an excellent actress. And it's like, she's not bad, but we get this like relationship with her and Annie. But what does it mean?
Don't these first three episodes feel like the last three? In a weird way.
Well, just
like
when,
just
when
the
Joy
stuff
tied,
that's actually happening
when
here.
Joy tied her up, I,
yeah.
I was like, how
that seems like a penultimate episode.
How
to me.
Are there seven more episodes?
I know.
Of this?
What are they fucking going to do in episode? There's 10 episodes this season or something like that.
Yes.
What are they going to do in episode 9 and 10 now? I mean, are they literally just going to have like the fucking town burning down like Salem's Lot?
I think they are. Well, because like think about everything like went apocalyptic at the end of last season,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like that's probably what they're going to build towards because Ace is building like this army of zombies. So it's like because in the third episode he gets the real estate agent and the cop
yeah.
and then and Abdi's like security guy buddy.
I hope the kid comes back because you know he's still there
so yeah so it's like
Skarsgård back
actually
What if they did? Would they just go all in? They just, you know, throw him back out there. He's like, I actually was causing this again. Well, put him back in the cage.
I mean, I just want our jokes to come true. I want Cooge. I want Christine. I want Jack Torrance.
Just throw on all the names of Stephen King on a wall and then take a dart and then, you know,
and let him
probably
walk,
gonna
let
get
him stroll
close.
In and give him a kid.
You know, hey, Joe Camber's probably alive now. So just go bring him back also. It's like, oh, you want to come up to my, I could fix your car. Oh, you're trying to get out of Castle Rock?
He's got like Cujo. And then he's like, oh, meet my buddy Cujo.
Yeah. Even in the first season, they mentioned Cujo already. Yes, so, yes. You know, why not? I hope the last episode takes place at a prom. And, you know, then we get another character. You know,
I feel like a lot of, CW. I don't know. I'll just say this. I feel like a lot of maybe people who really like this season who are listening to this are probably just like, why can't you just enjoy it? You know, and the thing is, why can't we just enjoy it?
I know
it?
We could.
But at the same time, it's like we can't because we are a podcast about Stephen King and we dig into these things and we think about these things and we're both critics too.
Yeah.
So it's like, we do think about these things this way, but also I also just don't on a purely entertainment level, I don't find it that gripping of television.
I don't either.
You know?
No.
I don't dislike it. I don't think it's, I don't think like storytelling wise, it's actively bad, but that is, I have a, when I work in a job where everything I watch is work and I have to watch stuff all the time, it's like, I would rather, not be watching this, but I have to because I'm writing Easter eggs posts. So,
so
read my Easter eggs posts on the AV Club.
Go for it, please, please do. Because honestly, if you're gonna catch, if you're gonna read anyone that has like the more Easter eggs, it's probably gonna be.
I will say, I read some other Easter eggs posts. I have more in mind.
I agree. I think that based on some of the ones that you've already shared me, I've seen other ones, and I'm like, oh, you missed a few.
And I also. And leaving my opinions out of those posts, so
which is good. I guess
they're very positive.
Not to piss off the big Castle Rock heads. What would they call them? I guess a castle heads or
rockers.
The Castle Rockers. I guess for me, the to explain why I am so vehemently opposed and angry about this show is. There's nothing worse than, a missed great opportunity.
Yeah.
Or a fumbled great opportunity.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like this season has done. Because for all the quote-unquote sins or negatives of that first season, I still enjoyed and liked and appreciated everything that they tried and, you know, they did and accomplished.
It was an admirable effort.
Yes. And it showed that there was still so much opportunity. Now, with this, I still think there's a lot of opportunity to go forward in the next seasons because they can, you know... They can do some, you know, they can still do some interesting stuff there. But what they've already done with this show by taking, you know, top five, top 10 most notable characters in Stephen King lore and then reintroducing me this way, it already is just kind of fractured what I really initially thought when I saw that first teaser back in 2017.
Yeah. So, we were so excited about
Castle. I remember we were all at the bar and Justin ran in. He was just like, they did it, guys. They did it.
Yeah.
This is the idea that I've had forever. And I can't even imagine what Justin's thoughts are on this. Like,
I joked with him. I sent him a text. I'm like, you are going to hate this.
Oh, yeah. Because it just goes against everything that was. Because like the way I saw Castle Rock was it was a sequel. It was a sequel series.
Yeah.
And that's not what this is. And
it was a sequel series about the world as much as the characters. Like, that's why I guess I know we probably said some degree to this before, but it's like, I love the concept of like, Alan Pangborn wasn't the main character. Mm-mm. He was a supporting character in the story of another story, but we also got a little bit of closure on his story.
Yeah.
I didn't love the way his closure happened, but at the same time, like, I liked seeing him in that capacity.
Yeah.
And so, and I guess like, maybe I'm getting that a little bit with Pop Merrill, but because I do think that out of the three characters, they're handling him the best, I guess.
Yeah.
Although I do feel like they've defanged him a lot, like because he's like a rattlesnake in Sundog. You know, he's bad.
Yeah.
Like
he's good here. I mean,
but
he's bringing the kids Nan's.
Yeah.
Nan's Luncheonette. That was a reference to a Castle Rock fixture.
Also, question. Are Salem's Lot and Castle Rock, because I was so...
Technically, they're not supposed to be that close to each other.
Yes, that's what I was saying, because yesterday when I was doing my Easter eggs post, I think like by the time I realized that, because I noticed in the map in the beginning, I was screenshotting stuff, and they wrote in Jerusalem's Lot on the map, like right next to Castle Rock, and I just kind of said, I remember that they weren't that close,
no.
But I didn't like investigate it like really hardcore. So
I think Derry is the closest to Castle Rock.
It basically seems like they're the same town.
Yeah,
they treat it that
they
way.
They do.
It's like they're a couple miles away.
Oh, I gotta go to my shift.
Yeah, Yeah, seriously. And so I like,
and it didn't even seem that way with like Mike Hanlon, or not Mike, with the kid who played Mike Hanlon. Henry Deaver's son.
Yeah, yeah.
He when he gets off the bus, it seems like he's still far away.
Yeah, he's still far.
He's still in Jerusalem's lot, which at that point was in the pitch darkness, and you assumed that it was an abandoned town. But anyway, I think the
biggest thing too, I know, but it's like, you just think about how they're ignoring the entirety of Salem's Lot.
I know.
They really are. It's just there in name. Like, it's just there in name. And like, there's no,
zoom in on the Marston house assumes that you have read Salem's Lot and that you're going to know what Marston is.
Yeah. So then why aren't we thinking about vampires?
Why are
they talking about witches when we know in the world of the Marston House and of Salem's
Lot? Or maybe they're misinformed and then they're going to see that. They go, we thought it was witches all along. It's vampires.
Oh, you know, one thing I added in my Easter egg post that I was like rather proud of, because it did actually feel very pointed. And in this case, I thought it was kind of neat. And maybe if they do a flashback to the witches, like, holy shit. Tim Robbins has a line where he calls them Satanists. And he goes, they were like bad people who made deal with a bad hombre. And I was like, Randall Flagg.
That would be amazing. Yeah.
Because like, then I was like,
maybe they could bring Alexander Skarsgård as.
I'm telling you, I would not be. Not Skarsgård. I doubt they would get Skarsgård, but although it would be interesting. Although, if they go back to the 1600s, which it seems like that's what they're hinting at, you know, because they keep mentioning this witch past, or maybe that's next season, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, well, they did a lot of teasing to the past in like the last season, and I thought that we were gonna, were gonna jump around, but I don't even know if they have the budget to do that, because I feel like they could have done the time jump in this one.
Yeah.
And it probably would have been better.
Because I guess, like, I thought it would have. I remember saying back when we first started talking about the show, I'm like, it might be interesting if they went back like 400 years.
Do the Fargo thing.
Yeah, yeah, do that. Like, just, or not even like much, like, get back into the old days. Like, what was the initial evil that made Castle Rock whatever? I'm like, I'd be up for that story.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what they're saying with witches and everything. So, but when Pop said the whole thing about a bad hombre, the way he phrased that, just, I was like, that sounds like Randall Flagg to me. And so I do think, I mentioned that in my piece, it would be kind of neat. Well, I'm not saying it would be neat if we saw it in the show, because it would just be, I'm like so annoyed with this show, but the concept that Randall Flagg was like 400 years ago making deals with Satanists, you know, that's fun to me.
It
I
is.
Love
yeah.
that kind of
yeah.
idea.
Well, that, and that type
well, because
of
you
stuff
think
is
of Eyes of the Dragon, you know?
Yeah. Oh, of course.
The
yeah.
fact that he spanned all these years and eras and everything, that's a character, that's an established precedent, and I'm into that idea.
Yeah, and like, you know? In those type of references, I'm all game for it.
Yeah.
So do that, but look,
I think we've exhausted ourselves.
I think I'm ready to leave Castle Rock
for
now.
Man.
I mean, maybe if we like and see what we, you know, by the end of it, we could do like a
recap. I think it could be healthy to do a postmortem after it's over, especially because we have such strong opinions right now.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, and I hope that this wasn't too negative for you guys. we're not haters, I swear.
I'm still going to be watching every episode.
Yeah, we have. You know. Well, I have to, but I would anyways. And so, yeah, so stay tuned, though, because I think the next couple weeks, hopefully, we'll have nicer things to say. We're excited about Dr. Sleep. We might hate it, too.
Oh, God. That would be a bummer.
But with Mike Flanagan's track record, I'm not planning on hating it, or I don't think I'm going to hate it.
I'm
but
hoping
we'll
for a win.
I'm hoping for a win. We need one, man. Yeah. We need one. And
less than a week.
Yeah.
That's
wild.
Crazy. I'm excited. I'm very excited.
Yeah, I am, too. So, that's our Castle Rock.
Yeah, that's it. Hope you enjoyed it.
Hope you liked it.
And
please yell at us online. I mean, we love hearing from you guys, because, you know, none of you guys are mean. Like,
no, not really.
I'm so used to people just being mean to me online.
I
like our listeners, because even when you disagree with us, you do it in a cool way.
And you send us really cool things. I mean, like Adam Dietz, he sent us all these cool photos from
his
trip to Bangor, Maine. Yeah. And that was so fucking cool. And like, I'm always seeing, like, someone sent us like the Stephen King birthday cake on Twitter. I thought that was just so awesome. So I love whenever we get, you know, feedback back from you guys. And
tell us why
awesome.
You love Castle Rock and why we're wrong. We will welcome that with open arms.
Absolutely.
Until next week,
long days and pleasant nights.
I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. But you know you want some.
Consequence Podcast Network. Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.